from Milieu Media Group, in association with Project Curate. This is The Relay, a podcast exploring what it means to build transformational, justice-driven communities and relationships today, with your hosts, Luke Brawner, and me, Seconda Joseph. Hello, welcome to The Relay. How you doing, Luke?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm
feel like
good.
We start the same way every week.
I know we do. It's just like saying, hey, how you doing? Yeah. You know,
we're still finding our rhythm.
We are. But I think I'm a person that, what they say, creature of habit.
Yeah.
How y'all doing? You know, I'll do that every time I see somebody.
It's always the funniest thing on a podcast, too, because they can't respond to you.
No,
exactly. You know?
But I feel like y'all here.
Yeah, it's true. Which kind of gets us into a thing that I want us to talk about. So we had a review pop up on iTunes this week, which, by the way, if you haven't reviewed the show, you should definitely do it. It's a huge help to us. It actually works into the like Apple Podcast algorithm to kind of put us in front of new listeners, which is great. But we had this really sweet review pop up. And one of the things that the reviewer said at the end of their review, it says, Seconda and Luke, let us all be a part of this open, transparent, and sometimes very difficult discussion. Thank you both. And I just want us to talk a little bit about the fact that that's something we really want to do better, to sort of invite other voices into this conversation.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that we talk about that a little bit, just that neither one of us intends to or can speak for everyone.
And which means that we misspeak.
Yeah.
Right. So I think, like, because even within that review, I think one of the things that stood out to me and why I wanted to share this online is because they're like, you know, I want to hear every word. Right.
Yeah.
And that's dope. Right.
That's dope.
It makes me real happy, y'all. I'm just, you know, because I believe the things that we are saying, like this show, the conversation. Like, I hope these conversations happen everywhere,
mm-hmm.
right? And I hope that they happen all over the world, which I heard, you know, I got some feedback from someone else who said that because, you know, our world needs to change. At the same time, just acknowledging the fact that we misspeak,
mm-hmm.
right?
Because we're coming from, we each have a limited perspective. And so we're bringing our particular intersections to the table. And we're talking about things that way transcend yeah. our limited perspective.
Yeah, and this is not, let me say this first, because saying we misspeak is like, oh, we're going to mess up. That's not why we're saying that. We're saying it because we're asking for accountability.
Yeah.
Right? So one of the things that we thought about, one of the things that we know we had to do before this show is to acknowledge the fact that we misspeak and to say that we're talking about ways to ensure that we walk in integrity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And not to create a space, because this is commentary, right? This part of the show,
mm-hmm.
you know, and even when we have guests, right? Like, this is what we see, right, mm-hmm. in the world, but particularly the opening and closing of the show, this is commentary, and we have to be very careful about our dialogue,
yeah.
right? And with our team, we're talking about ways to ensure that we don't end up perpetuating the things that we're trying to speak against.
Yeah.
Right.
And so with that, I think what we want in an attempt to sort of always further nuance the language that we use around what is very complicated to talk about, we want to invite our listeners' ears and voices yeah. into the conversation.
And see, for me, I think for Black people and for probably Latinx and for Asian people, this is not a difficult conversation to talk about.
Mm.
Like, I think even saying that, every time I hear it, I cringe,
really?
Right? Yeah, okay. Every time I hear that, I cringe. So that is not true for all our audience, right? However, it is true for some of mm-hmm. the folks that are listening and for some of the folks, you know, that need to hear the conversation.
What's funny is it's true for me because I don't want to make you cringe. I'm so
yeah.
sort of aware of not saying the wrong thing, trying
yeah.
to not say the wrong thing.
Yeah.
That's what I mean by it's complicated, is like, I just so don't want to be offensive. I just
yeah.
want to come to a place of deeper understanding
yeah.
and to co-conspire yeah. in this work.
Yeah. And I think that there is no way that a white person cannot be offensive when they begin to be a part of this work.
Mm.
Like, there's no way. That's just part of the process, and it may be part of the process forever, right? Because that's just the way the world is, right? Yeah. And if you're, I mean, whiteness is something that is taught, right? It's a way of being and seeing and thinking, seeing the world. Even, you know, with best efforts, right? There's a way that the world has been viewed, you know, the way that you've received knowledge and information that guides you, right? So it's not the best intentions. It's not going to, you know, and even not wanting to misspeak is not gonna stop you from misspeaking, right? It's just part of this thing. And I think just being okay with that and acknowledging, like, okay, this is what it is. Let me get into this fight.
Right. So that is the work of co-conspiring.
That's just the work of co-conspiring. Swallow that pill. Swallow that pill, brother.
It's funny because I'm my particular wiring in how I interact with any person is I sort of am always coming from a place of apology. I feel like I apologize to people all day long, every day.
Me too,
which is probably not a great thing, and I own that, but it already makes me think, like, okay, I'll do it. I'll swallow the pill, but let me just apologize in advance.
Don't feel bad, me too. Like, did I? Because I'm always thinking about the other person right in front of me, right? Which, you know, is important, I think. You know, at the same time, it's just like, just jump. Let's talk about the misspeak from last week, or something that could have been miss. We ended the conversation, or something like the conversation we were talking about, as far as like the dialogue. I think one of the things that we didn't point out that was important to say is that because we were talking about language and how language is used. And I think what I want to say is that the language that white people were using, the language that was given that white people were using when they say different things, it comes from a different place, right? Like, some of the language was racist, right? So,
meaning specifically to identify or specify race?
Yeah. Okay. And then I think I would also add that we don't have the same walk, right? So it's like there's a different place. A lot of times, okay, I'm gonna use this for example. Anybody who reads the Enneagram, right, you understand how it works, right? You may have two people who operate in the same way, but with the Enneagram, it's like, but your reason behind it is totally different. Right. So that's what I want to say for race. For example, Black folks might say or don't say a particular thing sometimes because of safety. Right. So, for example, we would not have a conversation on race amongst other Black people in a place because for us it's uncomfortable. It's not uncomfortable for us. It's easy. We live it. Talking is the easy part, right? But we wouldn't do it because it may not be safe for us. Like, the consequences for us is not uncomfortableness. The consequences for us is violence, right? So, like, it may start with Black folks in a restaurant having a conversation about race, and the easiest thing is maybe the waitresses are rude. Right? Maybe they ask us to leave. Maybe we don't, right? Maybe the cops are called. Maybe, you know, this escalation, like, what can happen if we open up, like, this is Pandora's box? Maybe it's nothing, right? Maybe they spit in our food. You know, like, so although sometimes things look like we have the same response to a particular thing, I hope I'm not talking in circles because I can sometimes. Our reasons behind it is different. One is safety, like literally our lives, cops, right? Death. And one is maybe being uncomfortable. Like a white person is not scared of talking about race because they might be killed. Now, they may be scared of saying a racist thing because of that. You know what I mean? But not talking about race because they're afraid for their life.
Right.
So I think in our previous conversation, like, we didn't make those distinctions, right? Even when you talk about people from different generations and why they say what they say.
Yeah.
And I think that is important to say, and we got called out on it, and it's real.
Yeah. And that's good. I mean, that is what we've taken on with this show, is to sort of bump into those things and navigate them together. And so I'm thankful for that kind of feedback. If people have feedback, if you hear something that's either triggering or that's encouraging, I mean, it could be on the other side too, something that particularly moving, then email us. We would love to sort of hear that feedback and discuss it on the show. Yeah. So you can email us at therelaypodcast@gmail.com, and we welcome that. We want to invite you fully into the dialogue and to help us sort of expand the limited perspective that we have so that we can be more nuanced in our language for the goal of truly co-conspiring in the work of making the world a more just place for all.
Yeah. And we're talking with our team again about ways to do that. Mm-hmm. So just keep listening for more ways to help us do it.
Yeah. For now, though, we want to get back into the conversation that was started last week, which was really getting into some of the language that we use, especially around the term people of color.
Yeah. And last week, we got into a little bit about anti-blackness. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think a lot of people have experienced anti-blackness, but you don't hear talking about language. You don't hear it as often as you hear racism, or you don't hear it as often as you hear people of color. But when you hear it, especially if you're a black person, like when you hear this term anti-blackness, you know what it means.
Yeah.
But just for people who want a kind of working definition of it, I found something from the Urban Dictionary, y'all. So it ain't valid. But you come up with your definition.
I learned a lot from Urban Dictionary. Right? So there's all kinds of things.
And the reason why I like this, because I've seen some other definitions, but it just, they wouldn't kind of expansive. It's real simple, though, right? You know what this is. It's like the personal, cultural, social, legal, and structural attacks on people called black, a term that some feel should replace racism as it is more focused on black people alone rather than all people of color. And I understand, that was my first time hearing that some people feel like we should use this more instead of racism, because just like the term people of color is broad, like I think anti-blackness is very specific to black people.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Right? And it's very prevalent. Like black people know it. And so, for example, anti-blackness is like a person may be, honestly, like whether they're white or whether they are like South Asian or East Asian or Latinx, right? You may can bring anyone home. Dating, you know, your family mm-hmm. members might be cool with you bringing anyone home, but not a black person, right? So that's very specific to black people. And the same thing, like, for example, I think one of the things that I always pay attention to is like you go in a business that may be owned by another person of color, right? And you see that like they generally hire other people of color who are not the same as them. Like other people of color, you see them hire, but you never see them hire black people, right? Just those sort of things. You white with all the other stuff. But when it comes to black people, you kind of fall in this. That's where the bigotry and the racism lies. And that's where, you know, you have a hard time releasing, because you can see everyone else's humanity. I think that is the important thing for me when it comes to anti-blackness. Like, these are the folks that you don't see humanity.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's where we sort of pick up this second half of the roundtable. Once again, with Stephen DeRosco, Jude Feng, Dr. Jessica Davenport, and you, Sekonda Joseph, talking about the subtle evolution of language.
As I really hold to the idea that we need to name specificity, and I'm just not one to use people of color a lot, like that's just not a part of my vocabulary really. But I do wonder what kind of advantage or positive utility does a term like people of color have? Does it happen? Is it always and already a political term that just waters everything down and just doesn't have any meaning? Or does it have any kind of merit whatsoever?
With this particular climate, I think it has merit.
Okay.
I believe it has merit. And it has merit because there are so many attacks on so many different people.
Right.
I had the opportunity to be a part of a conference. It's the AU. I'm looking at Jew. Y'all can't see me. I'm looking at Jew because he's Asian. And it was like an Asian conference.
Is
like, he knows. He don't know.
Was it interesting? Was
it very interesting.
Was it the OCA conference?
Okay. Yeah. The OCA conference. Okay. And what they were talking about was around this research that came out. Hoover research, mm-hmm. right? So this research said that it came out in November, right, 2018. And what came out was that basically, in quotations, y'all can't see these quotations, but in quotations, maybe we need to be careful and watch and see what is happening in the Chinese community, mm-hmm. period. Not just Chinese American, Chinese immigrants,
mm-hmm.
blanketed,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Not just fresh, like new immigrants, like folks that's been here, right? Because of the, and it talked about how China's influence on folks who are Chinese or who come from a Chinese background, mm-hmm. right? Who are American, mm-hmm. right? The ties could be dangerous to the U.S., right? And it's some very dangerous information because it talks about, you know, I think about the power, and we've talked about this in this place before. I've talked about how Chinatown for me is like, this is something that adds value and that adds is a liberation to Chinese Americans here. And it's something right. I would like to see African Americans have within the U.S., right?
Mm-hmm.
The reason why Chinatown, for me, has that is because also the connections to China,
mm-hmm.
right? Not necessarily to China, but mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. the banks that may have, it's like a community connection. And I'm saying that, I'm going around about way, but this is my point, mm-hmm. right? So in the research, they listed the fact that there are papers, there's news media that uses language that is specific to Chinese, mm-hmm. right? There is community organizers and community centers that still have connections in China. Well, of course, right? Wouldn't you have connections to your grandmother? Like, mm-hmm. wouldn't you mm-hmm. have connections to a bank that would actually give you a loan?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you have like cultural connections and language connections? Won't that give you a particular power? And the reason why at this conference, this was so important is because now they've already named well-known Chinese community people, right? That may be suspect.
Mm.
This has happened before. It's happened with the Japanese, it's happened with the Chinese
mm-hmm.
prior to, and it's something that's real. But the point is, there's some serious shiggity that's happening
yeah.
with so many communities who are non-white,
yeah,
right? And that label, when we say people of color, and we coming together around this particular administration,
right?
Right?
Uh-huh.
Hey, we need to get them out, because this is an enemy of all of us.
Yeah.
That's where it has merit.
Mm-hmm.
My brain wants to go towards the tangent of like Chinatown right. history. So I was like, no, let's bring it back to the to the original. Maybe that's for another day. But, you know, back to the idea of people of color being like a term of solidarity. So what does it mean in radical spaces when we're trying to do that, right? So, Sekonda, you said earlier, like that could be like a niceness that people play out, but like niceness doesn't do the real work of relationship,
yeah.
you know? And if we're talking about this being a unified term, like I think it really exposes some of the stuff that like even among different communities of color that we have to work out with each other, right? Like Stevens talked about it, there's like anti-blackness and like a whole bunch of other communities, right? Including like Asian American communities.
Anti-blackness is
yeah.
worldwide.
It's everywhere.
It's part
yeah.
of white supremacy.
Yeah.
It's part of the hierarchy.
Yeah. But I even remember, it was like years ago, but I went to this conference in San Antonio and it was supposed to be this radical conference. You know, people came from like all over the nation. And then during like the opening day, you know, they just had everybody do an activity and then they're like, would anybody like to share their thoughts? And then this older black man stood up and he started raving about China, right? And he was like, they're taking all our jobs and they're invading us. And this is like coming from an older black man, right? And then like all of us who are Asian like tensed up in the room, you know? And like there was already very few of us there to begin with. So we tensed up. And then this was a weekend long conference. And I think what was like challenging about that was like, okay, like that was not okay, right? Mm-hmm. But then on top of that, like, what did it mean? Like, it's okay that people come in with their different things, right? And we have to work that out. But what felt not okay for me was the fact that the moderators of the conference didn't choose to address that, right? So then what does that really mean when we say, like, we're going to come together? Like, as a Chinese person, do I swallow the really racist thing that you said? Mm-hmm. You know, do Black folks have to swallow the really anti-Black things that, like, you know, Asian folks say or other folks say, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it goes to the, like, if we're going to really work through kind of the textures of what that term could really mean for power, like, that means we have to work out some of our stuff within our own communities.
Can I say something? And while we're here, might as well address it. Mm-hmm. Like, that is absolutely true. And I also have to add that, like, in my opinion, the anti-Blackness worldwide is so strong and horrific. It's like they're not equal. Right? It's not equal. And it's not equal because it's about power, right? So, like, when I say that, I mean, like, in African-American communities, and this is where this comes from. Like, people come into African-American communities welcoming, mm-hmm. you know, we spend money at places where people have businesses, and nationwide. As a matter of fact, now I know it's in other countries. People treat Black people like they are trash, like in these, mm-hmm. and a lot of the African-American sentiment with folks, whether it be like people from Asia or people from like South or East Asia, mm-hmm. which there's a lot, or some in North Africa even, mm-hmm. it's like, it's because of the racism, mm-hmm. like that's constant. And racism works on a hierarchy. Like, I cannot deny that, of course, there's anti-immigrant mm-hmm. sentiment in the African-American community. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, I would also say a lot of it does not necessarily come from, like, I just don't like you because of who you are. It comes from the hurt and the pain that's piled on top of mm-hmm. these, like, these particular communities because mm-hmm. of the anti-Blackness. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm inclined to really agree with that. So I think that there is this hierarchy. And I do think that anti-Blackness, you know, kind of grounds all of it in a way, in the sense that it seeps into everything and in every community, right? But I think what is important, at least for me to sometimes acknowledge, is while there might be a hierarchy that impacts different groups differently, yeah. the logic is very much the same, right? In the sense that the similar kinds of logics that impact and that keep immigrants out are the similar kinds of logics that also guide segregationist principles against Black people, right? The kinds of logics of the in and the out, the power dynamic, all of these kinds of things, I think what we tend to miss, we need to get these specificities right. I think we also need to get right the way in which anti-Blackness grounds much of what we see in terms of inequity. What we also need to get right is that white supremacy is a logic that works through mm-hmm. and through.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And so, like Jude has pointed out, that it, you know, if we get together in terms of solidarity, we have to work out these nuances and these differences in anti-Blackness and anti-immigration. We have to work that out. I think what we also have to really identify is that white supremacy is what guides mm-hmm. all of this shit, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to not let white supremacy off the hook ever. Right. Because the minute we do that,
that's true.
We miss the mark. Right. We've missed the mark in terms of naming what's really going on. I think it's necessary to name these experiences and how they happen differently. That's necessary. But it's important for me not to separate myself from what's happening at the border as a Black mm-hmm. person.
Absolutely.
Like, it is necessary that I not see mm-hmm. that as right. Because yeah. it's the same logic. Mm-hmm. It is the exact same mm-hmm. logic.
It's mm-hmm. the exact same logic. And I think my point was to, for me, it's very difficult because we're talking about unity, right? That's what people of color is. We're unified under that.
Sure.
All those things are important.
Sure.
However, when we come into those rooms and we don't acknowledge the truth.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a Black person. I've been in stores oftentimes. I had some Asian folks at my high school. right? Mm-hmm. And they were well-off Asians. I really didn't know them because the year I came, they was going out, right? It was gentrifying the community. It was the rich people was leaving the high school.
Yeah.
But my experience with Asian Americans, my experience with a lot of people from outside the U.S., was the experience that I had in my community.
Yeah.
And a lot of those experiences were I was treated like I knew that I was Black. Like there was mm-hmm. as much. So when I come into these rooms and I come into these spaces, mm-hmm. I've been on a job,
yeah. mm-hmm.
right? I've come into them with these experiences, not just from white people.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, if you're in a lower economic community, you have less contact with white people,
yeah.
unless it's in management. Right. The That's people right. that are your bosses mm-hmm. are other people of color.
Yeah.
The people who give favor on your jobs mm-hmm. are other people of color.
Mm-hmm.
So then you go into this room and you say, yeah, I see your plight and you're right. Like I feel that's right, but you're yeah. killing me.
Yeah.
You know, so my thing is we cannot not acknowledge mm-hmm. that experience. Mm-hmm. It's not like an experience where somebody just comes in and say, I don't like you. Like white people. That's mm-hmm. my point. Mm-hmm. That comes in and say, oh, I don't like you because you such and such. Like there's some experience that comes in
yeah.
when Black folks open their mouths. Yep. And I'm not trying to take up for Black people because I'm Black. You know,
but just, that would be okay if you were.
And I was. Yeah. And if it's true. Yeah. I mean, as a Black person who loves humanity.
Yeah.
As a Black person who's very concerned about what happened at the border, who's educated on the border, who knows that the people that are coming are all, you know what I mean? Black folks coming through too, right? And who loves these people. I also know that there is some extreme issues.
Yep.
And how can I stand and fight for you, right? When I know when I go home, I've been in myself flooded. Water up to here, car gone. I walk outside. I'm downtown Houston. First person I see is a Latino person. Maybe they were white Latino. I don't know, but I could tell they was Latinx, mm-hmm. right? They saw that I got out the car. They saw that I wasn't, you know, with a gun. They scared. They like, mm-hmm. they can't help me.
Mm-hmm.
Then I see a white person. It's 5:30 in the morning. It's pitch black. I'm a woman.
Mm.
I've had these type of experiences with other people of color.
Mm-hmm.
Black people don't treat me like that,
mm-hmm.
generally. So, like, I'm walking into the room with this. How we not address it?
Mm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, I'm thinking, I'm, like, getting the image because I'm a very visual person and I like to create clever type of little metaphors of like how I see it. Race relations in general, everything that goes into it, like the things that it builds and the things that it affects, whether you're talking about politically, economically, socially, emotionally, I picture it as like a nuclear reactor and you're like in the control room and it has all these different buttons and things that you have to use to like maintain the balance, which is the purpose of a nuclear reactor. You got to maintain that balance. So the more we talk about people of color as a term, I think about it as like this like level thing that we have to keep at a certain thing because if not, it goes out of balance. And that thing that's out of balance is basically colorism.
Yeah.
If you don't keep the use of people of color in check, then all of a sudden you're going to slip into some colorism that's not being called out.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like our job to operate this control room, this race relations, to make sure that everything that's working is working. And like, you know, one thing that we can at least say before we start putting the extreme weight on our shoulders of our responsibility is that this control room has been out of whack for like the creation of this control room, right? So like, we never had it right. So we could like at least breathe a sigh of relief of like, all right, at least we're not worried about messing it up because we're trying to fix it. These conversations are actually about studying and tweaking it and getting it to just be, you know, where it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Because I see it as, I'm always looking at everything politically because I really don't see a point in understanding how to do the day-to-day if you're not understanding how things are working against you. So what I see is obviously the term people of color going to being used as much as possible in mainstream language in order to, you know, allow colorism to slip in whenever it comes to the details of what people don't see. Like, you know, people see presidential debates, but they don't see the advisors and the staff that's behind them. They don't see the party representatives that have different positions and party affiliated people. And all these people make decisions all the way down to a local level. We have a local party and those are people with jobs that have like hierarchies and within themselves of who's boss and who's that boss. And everybody has to check in with each other. So like the colorism starts seeping in when you get to say our organization here politically has full representation of people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see is mostly, yeah, sure, you could say it's people of color, but it's a lot of light-skinned people.
Mm-hmm.
And they may not have necessarily the best outlook for darker skinned people mm-hmm. of any race, whatever they fall on the spectrum of the ethnicity. So that's why I mean, like, you know, we see this term being used as like people of color, and it's like we got a good representation of people of color, but then those same people are applying colorism to their daily practices and their daily positions and their influences and their power. So yeah, that's a thought I had as I was listening to y'all talk.
Kind of building off of that, like, you know, even within like the Asian / Asian American, I don't even want to say community because it seems so monolithic when it's not. It's actually very like, you know, like everybody's in their own separate ethnic enclaves, mm-hmm. national enclave, you know, nationality enclaves. Like, I feel like colorism is, for me personally, just a phrase that resonates more because I feel like I grew up with that mentality far more than for my parents. It wasn't necessarily framed around blackness. That's not to say there wasn't anti-blackness there, but it's to say that, like, there was this, like, pecking order of how they saw even, like, other Asians, you know what I mean? And, like, certain racism that played out that way, right? And I think, to Stephen's point, like, even when we talk about who's represented in these spaces, like, it's often people who can mirror kind of the ruling class, right? In the API community, there's this huge kind of push right now called disaggregate the data, where, like, so many times when people think about who Asians are, right, like, they're thinking about the wealthy Asians, the well-to-do Asians, the Princeton Asians, right, the Tiger Mom Asians. And, like, by and large, that's mostly, like, East Asians, like Chinese, Japanese, Korean, you know, not entirely. But, you know, like, when you start looking through kind of some of the other experiences, actually, like, there are people in the API community that, even compared to, like, Black communities and Latinx communities, are some of the, like, struggling the most, like, most under-resourced. But they get obliterated under the Asian umbrella, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, so that's almost like a, like, another variation of how kind of that blanketing can override. And then when you look at what does it look like when people apply for colleges, or what does it look like when people are going for benefits, right? And people say, like, oh, this is a needs-based, and they're assessing based off of race. They check the box, you're Asian. They go, you don't need it as much, or we don't actually have a scholarship set aside for you people. Because, you know, so that impacts people across kind of that spectrum of, like, colorism as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it also, and maybe you can speak to this, Jude, a little bit, it also works the other way around in terms of Asians as well, in the sense that I've been to a number of, like, you know, look at like demographics at universities and the way that they tend to get their diversity numbers is through admitting a groundswell of Asian American folks.
Oh, yeah.
So that when Black folks show up, when Latinx folks show up and say, we're having issues here at these institutions, they point to their people of color number and their diversity number, which is really this huge Asian American number, right? Yeah. I mean, there's a way in which Asian Americans are employed to different, like, utilized to different aims.
There's a great example, and I'm always bad at citing things specifically. So it's just like these, like, wishy-washy kind of, like, somewhere around there. But just a couple years ago, I think up in New York, and I think it happened both at the university level, and it also happened, I think it was Harvard even, but even within public school districts, where there's talk about how to kind of reshuffle so that it would be more racially equitable, I think, with Black folks in mind, right? And then it was actually, like, Asians, and I would even say, like, Chinese people, who actually came out against it, saying that it would harm Chinese people. And then for one of those cases, the lawyer that represented them was the same one that represented Abigail Fisher, at UT, trying to say that she kind of was squeezed out, you know, due to
not having the qualifications.
So, but then, so I think what was so interesting, because, you know, like, my newsfeed, I come from a lot of, like, you know, the Chinese community, but I'm also, like, you know, hanging out with radicals. And so it was this very split positioning of how people were feeling about it. And I found it so fascinating. And there was so much anger on both sides. And I feel like one layer of the conversation that was missing was also, like, one, I felt like that was totally wrong of the Chinese folks. But the other side of it is also how readily other people of color were willing to attack Chinese folks, but have not been as vocal, or maybe have been as vocal, but not in sort of this, like, unified force, when it's been white people who have, like, had the kind of, like, control and have kept other, you know, these, like, Ivy League kind of, like, legacy schools, right? So it's like, so, I mean, it goes back to kind of the white supremacy and how the whole, like, divide and conquer, you know, that, like, we're really pit against each other. And I was like, and for me, I was like, I don't think the Chinese folks that are like standing behind this are right at all. Like, mm-hmm. I'm totally, you know, and there were like Chinese folks on the other side that were also like opposing where that contingent was going. Mm-hmm. But I was like, you know, there's this really fascinating meta conversation that we're not happening around, mm-hmm. like, how are we choosing to move around this? And yep. it seems like we're choosing more to fracture than to find ways to unify, mm-hmm. you know? And so I thought that was very interesting.
I do have one other question, and this is specifically for you, Jude. Another term that kind of floats around amongst like conversations about people of color is like the term of model minority, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that, Jude, because I think when we talk Asian Americans,
that's huge.
And white supremacy and
absolutely.
How we are pitted against each other.
Yeah. So, you know, oftentimes it's said that model minority is kind of used as like a wedge piece between white folks and other communities of color, right? So like Asians are typically primed to be this model minority, kind of mm-hmm. like, oh, it like sort of reinforces the whole like pull yourself up by your bootstraps, mm-hmm. this like meritocracy that mm-hmm. like, look, this group of minorities managed to work hard enough to get through, right?
Mm-hmm. Whereas and Asian like, Americans are pointed to
correct.
As the
yeah,
minority.
Yeah, and then kind of looking at other communities, like, why aren't you doing that, mm-hmm. right? And so I think it's really fascinating. And again, I think everything cuts both ways. Like, I think on one hand, like, it really is divisive. There are a lot of Asians that buy into that and really see themselves as, like, separate and better than, like, you know, like, Black and brown folks, right? Other communities of color. But then very similarly, I see like progressive Asian Americans that are constantly railing against the model minority myth in a way of trying to be like, this actually harms people in our community. So kind of going back to the way that the blanket statement, like there are people who are not models. There are mm-hmm. people who like genuinely struggle that didn't enter based off of education or professional kind of opportunities, right? So like, so it cuts that way. And mm-hmm. then the fact is that even those of us that are really trying to work in solidarity with other communities, there's this kind of weirdness. I think sometimes people look at Asians as kind of like next to white, mm. right? And so mm-hmm. there's an expectation of us showing up like as a white ally. Mm-hmm. And that's really frustrating for me, right? I'm like, I can definitely stand by the fact that anti-Blackness is a problem and that happens in our communities. And that as like Asians who like have like really enjoyed just staying under the radar, kind of on the tails of like, you know, how anti-Blackness plays out, like we've gotten to raise up our own, right? But I think there's also this side of saying that like, when I think, and especially Asians, I think we struggle with a sense of our political identity, mm-hmm. right? So when we're trying to actually work that out and articulate it, but there isn't the space to say like, yes, we are coming in. Yes, we are coming in as allies. But then to say, no, we're not white allies, but we're still trying to sort out, like, in some ways, like, what does that mean, right? I think when the expectation for us is just to show up as white allies, because, like, people don't have, like, Asians don't have the space to work that out. I think sometimes people just assume that. And so I've seen Asian communities kind of, like, you know, I think when BLM kind of first, like, became a thing, like, I saw a lot of, like, Asian American folks seem to express white guilt. And I found that very fascinating, mm. right? And these are people that had like, who I think have been very latent in processing some of their own experiences of racism. Mm. You know, we're automatically signing up to say like, we have white guilt, you know, like not in that phrase, mm-hmm. but certainly the way that, you know, kind of the psychology around it. And so I think it just cuts in so many different directions. Like, I don't think it benefits anybody, you know?
I think these conversations are important because if we don't peel back the layers, even within our own communities, like you talked about the expansiveness of the Asian community. And we were talking earlier about this report that's coming out that specifically surrounded, you know, that talks about the Chinese community, right? And one of the things that folks were trying to figure out is like, how do we grapple like within this conference, you know, with or even us just creating the curriculum or sharing the curriculum with the conference? It was like, how do we grapple, like this is specific to the Chinese community, right? And what is it that we can say and do to make sure that others know that this is important for you as well, right? So if that's something that's happening within, you know, Asian community, that it's huge, mm. you know, it's these conversations and this work is not easy. Same thing with the Latinx community, right? Like there are like colorism, where colorism is a major issue. And you're mm-hmm. right, like it has all the layers of all the peoples.
Yeah. That's why to me it's so important that we have in the Latinx community this conversation in a lot more louder fashion, because we're no longer in the regular set of circumstances that the country were 50 years ago. Texas is about to have in about, I think they said within the next, by 2022, Latinx folks will be the majority in Texas. And Harris County already is the majority. That's why I feel like we need to now retire the whole minority language, mm-hmm. because depending on the state you're in, the city you're in, white by default shouldn't be majority. Mm. Matter of fact, they start fitting to the minority. So it's kind of like, I think that's, and that's a clear response, what we've seen in the past couple of years with the administration and the Republican Party, what they like decided to swing for politically as far as the ideology. So my job that I told myself I'm going to make sure that I do consistently is that as Texas and as Houston starts to have this Latinx insertion of like these political spaces and offices and positions of influence, is that I check them consistently. Don't let them think that they are running with the people of color tag and saying that this is progress, because the necessity to not allow another political system to start inserting itself Latinx and then not let it be properly trimmed, you know, like the weeds that it is that it grows. And so, like, you know, I've seen many examples of this, and recently in the news, like one of the more celebrated films that came out of Mexico was about an indigenous woman in Mexico that was a housemaid, mm-hmm. and the Mexican industry, Hollywood industry, like their version of Hollywood, you know, there was a group chat of very famous white, blue-eyed, blonde Mexican actresses trashing the actress that is getting all the attention because she is not of the same stature, like height-wise, and, you know, she doesn't have the European model build, and she's brown-skinned, and she's indigenous. Her indigenous features are very apparent, and, you know, that's the kind of things that, you know, we want to make sure that we highlight and call out in the Latinx community whenever we're starting to enter these spaces of influence now that we're politically changing the landscape in Texas. We want to make sure that we're not upholding white supremacy with a Spanish accent. Mm.
You mentioned, when you were talking, one of the things that came to my mind was that, okay, so that's where the power is at with the name, the people of color, right? So just thinking of majority and minority. So I think when using those terms, even in places outside of Texas, right, where you don't necessarily have one group of people like the Latinx community in Harris County that makes, you know, people of color minority. Mm-hmm. But when you go like somewhere else where together, you know what I mean? Sure. Like the black, brown, Asian, you know, folks are the majority now, mm-hmm. and using that term, mm-hmm. like people of color, to, you know, push mm-hmm. against white supremacy a bit mm-hmm. can be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I think that can be, it can have some utility in that way, like as a way for not just people of color across these various different races and ethnicities to push against, but also like to take up space, right? Yeah. And to really claim that as a mode of movement, is to say, you know, we are here and we are going to take up, you know, space in a way that you have to recognize that we have space in this place, mm-hmm. right? But I also think that does require what Jude was talking about earlier, is some intentional conversations around solidarity and some intentional conversations around how white supremacy runs through and impacts these various different mm-hmm. groups in different ways that are significant. Mm-hmm. We have to talk about those different ways, but it just requires some intentionality, I think, in order for it to work, mm-hmm. because we can say that we're all people of color and that we are now the majority, but if we're not operating politically in that mm-hmm. way, I'm not sure that it matters very much.
Right. They're not going to put that in the census. Are you a person of color or not? You know, it's going to be specific, and they don't pass laws based on that person of color. Last week, I was at the county commissioner's court by chance when they were passing a resolution and discussing about the passage of a resolution of making sure that all county employees are protected under LGBTQIA protections, right? So they want non-discriminatory practices. And, you know, the people that were opposed on it, the commission's opposed on it, you know, they're from the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And one of their arguments was exactly that. It's like, why do we need to have specifically laid out each name detail of these identities? Why can't it just be, we won't harass people because people are people. Everybody's people. Mm-mm. Right? So that's just one word out of the three we're discussing today, people of color. Mm. So I can see that being flipped and used in a convenient way. Like, we just don't discriminate against anybody, people. Mm-hmm. If you are a person, then you are protected, right? So that's where I see this logic of, like, just being detailed. And I have no problem being that person in that room when somebody says, especially in the situations appropriate, to say people of color, I'm probably going to be the ones like, who you mean specifically? Mm-hmm. You know, because, like, honestly, like, you got to do that. You got to make sure that you're not letting them, you know, brush over the cracks with, like,
because that discrimination looks differently depending on who we're talking about.
Right.
And so if we're talking about doing actions differently, well, then we need to know what those actions look like.
My thoughts are, like, in a different place. Like, I find it interesting that white folks, you know, the minute that their number's like 49%, they're like, we're the minority. Mm-hmm. And it's like, are all the other people of color this one thing to you? And then you're, you know, because by no means is any particular group of color suddenly the majority over white folks, you know. So, I mean, also to kind of what everybody's saying is, you know, like, when we as quote unquote this umbrella people of color come into a majority, like, it's still just a whole bunch of us with still a lot of fractures, you know?
So it's like, it certainly doesn't mean the white supremacy goes away.
Yeah,
it doesn't.
Yeah.
So there was a line that Jude said early in that conversation that I wanted to revisit and just sort of hear your thoughts on this. He says that niceness doesn't do the real work of relationship. I would love to hear how you sort of interpret that and what you think that means in the work of co-conspiring.
Oh, let me tell you, I'm not going to be personal with this because I want to go all the way, put all my business in it, but I'm not. I'm going to show some restraint. However, like, he's absolutely correct. When you're being nice, there's a thin line between nice and kindness. It's not the same thing, right? You can be nice to a person, smile at them. Oh, yeah, I agree with that. Oh, how, blah, blah, blah. But not trust them enough to tell them the truth. Right? So you never solve the problem because you're dancing around things. Like, niceness is like, can we all just get along? Like, what we opened up with, like, for the first show. But being nice does not build, you cannot build a relationship without truth. Like, you have to be able to say, this is not well. You have to be able to say, you know, like, what you said, I know it wasn't intentional, but I feel like that was racist. I feel like that kind of what we talked about earlier, like, I think that's like white centering. Like, you have to be able to say that. Like, me and you are having this conversation and, you know, we are creating a program, us along with Jessica and, you know, all the folks who have been around this round table. But if we're not able to tell each other the truth and we're not able to discuss where we think there are issues are, right, or say when we're uncomfortable, it's fake and it's phony and it's, there is no depth in that relationship. It is like, it's glass. And justice work, like, if you're doing justice work and you're in it for the long haul, we're not even talking about friendship. I want to make that a distinction.
Right.
We're talking about relationship.
Right.
Right. So in relationship with someone, in doing justice work, like, I have to be able to be honest with Jude. Jude has to be able to be honest with me and trust that. In that honesty, like, that, the relationship is not going to fall apart because we're both committed to this work, right? We're both committed to creating a more equitable world wherever we have our influence. So if Jude tells me, you know, or you tell me, you know, or I tell you, you know, like, hey, I'm uncomfortable with this. Right? That doesn't mean this is over. That doesn't mean that trust has been broken. Like, trust is not broken because we're not offended.
That's interesting. So that's interesting because the opposite would mean that if you tell me when I say something that's not okay and you say, oh, it's fine, then actually trust is broken then, because you're having to lie to me. Niceness is so nice. I was going to ask you, like, so if niceness doesn't do the real work of relationship, what does? And it sounds like what does is truth. Truth does truth. The real work of
and
relationship.
And truth is so difficult. It's so difficult. But what makes truth better, what makes truth easier is people like really being committed, I think, and people really saying, I'm in this to win this, and people continually practicing telling the truth, right? And creating space for people to tell the truth.
Like to not feel like the entire relationship hinges on some particular feedback that you might offer. Does that make sense?
What do you mean by that?
So what I mean is, like, what you just said to me a minute ago is like the most helpful thing, when you said that, like, just because I'm honest with you about something, that I'm not saying that this is over.
No.
Like, for me, that's the sort of weight that I bring to it, of thinking, yeah, like, if I offend this person, if I ever misstep, which is, gets back to what we talked about in the beginning, if I ever misspeak, if I ever misstep, I've blown it. And especially on a podcast where the whole world can hear, I wish the whole world was listening. They're not yet.
But, yes, they are.
But in a very public space like this, yeah, if I misspeak, it's on the record, and I'm going to have to, everything hinges on that. But to sort of feel the relief of like, no, I can receive feedback from you and we can continue on, yeah, in this journey. And just, you know, sort of, you acknowledged at the beginning that like, there's no way for me to approach this conversation and never misspeak. That's, yeah, not, it's not going to happen. I'm going to do it.
Yeah. And there's no way to enter into this work and to decide that, you know, you're going to build community with folks and you're going to build something of equity and you're going to influence, you know, systemic racism in a way that, you know, brings about equity, and think that mistakes are not going to be made. Like to think, you know, that a white person is not going to mess up. To think that a black person like myself, who's not LGBTQIA, that builds a relationship and, you know, walks in a posture of being a co-conspirator with friends and family and community that are LGBTQIA, to think that, you know, maybe there's a posture, I need to be careful. Like, of course I'm gonna be careful. Like, of course there's some stuff that's not gonna, do you know what I mean? I'm not LGBTQIA, yeah, right?
Yeah.
So that means that I have to walk in a certain posture. And at the same time, like, not that folks have to teach me about certain things, but I'm in it to win it. So even when, you know, I mess up, misspeak, or whatever, like, that means I'm giving this up, because this is something I'm dedicated to, regardless. It's not hinged on somebody else's acceptance of me. It's not hinged on my perfection, which would be perfect, if great, if I was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But like my therapist just told me, I ain't God. You know, so like that, it's not going to work like that. Yeah. You know, it's not going to work like that. But because of my commitment, then I do walk in a particular posture. And because of folks who are committed to justice work, then even when you're not supposed to just be able to just willy-nilly.
Right.
When you correct it, like, correct.
Right.
And sometimes self-correct. Like, sometimes we know self-correct when possible. And when it's not, then just receive it and then just keep moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that's with any type of relationship, like anything that any human is building with other people.
Yes. So next week, we're back with another roundtable. This will be you and Brandi Holmes, who's been on the show, and Jude Fang, once again, talking about a book that's been massively influential to sort of y'all's whole community of, yeah, around Project Curate. It was discussed a little bit in those early, that first roundtable, but Adrienne Marie Brown's Emergent Strategy. And so please come back and join us. In the meantime, we welcome your feedback. You can also review the show on Apple Podcasts. That's a huge help to us. Sikanda, once again, thanks for all that you're doing with this show.
Thank you, Luke.
We'll see you next week.
Peace.
The Relay is produced, edited, and mixed by me, Luke Bronner. It's co-produced by Dr. Jessica Davenport, and our artwork is by Heather Hale. Check out more of her work at halehouse.co. Learn more about Project Curate at projectcurate.org and The Relay at therelaypodcast.com. For bonus content from this and other Mill U Media Group podcasts, check out the Patreon link in the show notes for this episode.